up the hill, staring at her, and then at the sky. What she initially saw, that white wisp, was only the beginning. The first tentacles of a roiling bank of clouds stacked up on the horizon. Chapter 13. When Clark rouses them from sleep, when she calls them up the hill, when they look to the sky and see the clouds piled up like tangled gray scarves, the others cry out with delight at the promise of shade, of moisture. But Lewis goes silent because he sees something else. He sees the man in white, Aaron Burr. He takes up half the sky. His hair is wild, windblown. His eyes and mouth are lit with balls of lightning. His hands, with torn gray fingers, reach for him, beckoning. He haunts Lewis. Whether he is asleep or awake, Burr is there at every turn, summoning him. His skin is so pale, Lewis can see the veins marbling greenly beneath it. His knuckles are cubed with arthritis. His mouth is a hole that holds a shadow when he whispers his name.
Lewis.
Isn't that what he should expect? With his brain drying like a nut from lack of water, with the heat warping the air and the sun heliographing off broken nests of glass? A mirage? But he doesn't see water, and he doesn't see his office, the two things he longs for most. He sees Burr. Lewis was, in his previous capacity, not a teacher but an educator, a curator of stories meant to help people better understand their lives. The museum might make them feel a little richer, or entertained, or wistful, or it might make them feel like an irrelevant bit of debris caught up in the cyclonic rotation of history. He didn't particularly care. He just wanted to be sure they knew this wasn't it. The sanctuary was not the world, and human history was a long gauntlet of troubles and triumphs they might learn from, aspire to. But that life is far behind him now. He no longer frames his thoughts around nurturing others, but on feeding himself, gobbling up everything he encounters. There is nothing in this new America not worth learning. He is the student, a disciple. He bothers Joya whenever he can, but even if she wasn't temporarily mute from her injury, he suspects she would give him only so much. There is a notable reluctance whenever someone approaches her with a question. If you can make birds come to your rescue, why can't you ward off a snake or lure in a rabbit? Her stick sketches the sand. Ask, not make. You ask, so you're saying not everything answers, not everything wants to listen. Why is her shorthand for yes? Did Burr teach you how to ask? Why, she writes, and N. He said we're the same. Do you think we're the same? She looks at him with those depthless eyes, then circles what she has already written. Y and N. And then when he asks if she can teach him, she makes a circle within the circle, around the letter N. She is the messenger. Burr is the educator, and Lewis is impatient for an education. He felt the same way as a child, pulling down books in the library and asking his father to talk to him about them. I'm too busy, might have been the phrase his father said to him most often, next to quiet. When he remembers his father, he remembers him from a distance, studying documents at a desk, or meeting with advisors in a boardroom, or giving speeches on a stage, only occasionally looking up to find Lewis, staring back at his son not with pride or affection, but with disappointment. This man, Aaron Burr, who lavishes Lewis with attention, who summons him in dreams and in life, who promises him guidance, appears the same age as his father, his hair and beard wilder, but his appearance otherwise similar, so that they are beginning to merge in his mind. Burr wants him, his father wants him, and he feels as excited by this as he does frightened. They hurry to gather their belongings, to feed and water and saddle their horses, who seem infected by their energy when they set off, no longer stumbling or ignoring their reins, but riding hard and straight toward the clouds, despite their bloodied hooves, toward the man whose vaporous shape Lewis can still see. He longs for a sniff from his silver tin, but knows he must ration it better, It spikes his mind and numbs his senses. Sometimes his thoughts feel so alive and singular that he could shed his body altogether, peel it off like a wet jacket. And sometimes he imagines the sand as powder, imagines diving off his horse head first into a pillowy pile of it, and he would breathe, breathe, breathe until he is overcome with pleasure. They slow to a canter when noon comes, and the clouds burn away. By then, there are birds, not just the crows and vultures they are accustomed to seeing, but a red-winged blackbird, a yellow tanager, even an owl that hoots at them from a high branch. At one point, a murmuration of starlings darkens the sky, like a net cast over them. They drop down into the Missouri River, their constant guide, leaning back on their horses as they slide and stutter down the sandy banks, and then follow its wide-walled passage. Its bed is clay cracking beneath their hooves. They startle three deer bedded down in the shade of a root-twisted overhang and fire three bullets and two arrows uselessly after them. The water they don't find for two more days. Lewis senses something different. The air takes on a greater texture, less thin and dry, more palpable, and so does it ripen with a fecund smell, like the breath of an unwashed mouth. Then he notices the riverbed, softening. The sound of the clay shattering, once echoing all around them, hushes, and then vanishes as the ground grows spongy, and then sticky with muck. Reed is the one who points it out, shouting, "There!" A great gray tongue of mud twisting its way down the middle of the riverbed. For a quarter mile they follow it. It grows wider, eventually reaching from bank to bank before giving way to a brackish puddle with salt formations like small cauliflower growing around it. York lets out a whoop and shifts out of his saddle and falls to the ground and scrambles on all fours to the edge of the puddle and splashes a handful into his hair before dunking his face beneath the surface to taste it. He reels back, his face distorted. He heaves several times. A line of bile hangs from his lips when he looks up at them. Joanna nudges her horse and shakes her head and tisk-tisks him with her tongue. York laughs, the laugh cut short when Clark spurs her horse between him and the girl and berates him for his damned fool idiotness. The way is now impassable, too swampy for them to ride, and they clamber up the banks and parallel its winding course for an hour. Algae thickens, bushes cluster, reeds spring up. Leaves unfurl from branches. To Lewis's eyes, so accustomed to browns and grays, everything seems obscenely green. There is a whine at his ear, and then a sting at his cheek. He slaps it and studies the bloody smear on his hand. He hears another slap behind him, and the doctor says, "What is that? What are they?" Lewis wipes his hand on his thigh. "Mosquitoes, I think. They drink blood and carry disease." The bugs thicken, swarming in hazy clouds, and the slapping and clapping becomes as frequent as applause. York says, "Why couldn't they have been wiped out with everything else?" "Purely to harass you," Lewis says. York laughs, they all do, despite the welts rising from their skin, because there is water. There is actual water beside them, oozing along thickly at first, then clearing and broadening, creeping up the banks. And where there is water, there is life. The desert has filled their heads with questions and defiled their spirits, but now all those bad feelings wash away. Juwayo was right. There is an end to the desert waste, which means they have been right to follow her. She has led them to life, and they are going to live. When the sun eases toward the horizon, when the shadows begin to cluster, the doctor walks her horse onto a rocky shoal and stares out over a calm stretch of water, dimpling with bugs, and says, "Let's stay here. And I don't just mean for the night. Let's rest. We need our rest." When no one says anything, the water has stolen their words, she says, "I insist on it. This will be good medicine for us all." Right then, a possum, with a long pink tail and a mouth full of needle-like teeth, clambers down a tree and hisses at them before Reed puts an arrow in its side. Lewis knows that with prey come predators, North America was once home to big mammals that long ago went extinct. Once humans crossed the land bridge, once they notched out shell-shaped projectile points, once they learned to fire arrows and hurl spears with otolotls, the big animals began to die off. The mammoths, the dire wolves and lipiterns, the saber-toothed lions, the giant ground sloths, and the giant short-faced bears. All gone, replaced by scrawnier, deadlier humans. Nature fills a void. Now that humans are gone, something big will be clambering its way to the top of the predatory chain. He remembers what Joea wrote in the sand. Goblins. And while they butcher the possum and talk excitedly about what tomorrow might bring, he keeps his eyes on the dark forests that wall the riverbank. Chapter 14. The melanoma arises from the tip of his ear. It has been bothering Thomas for weeks, a faint itching at first, then a throbbing. It is a raised lump, darkly pigmented, purplish at its center, pink and yellow along the edges. Vincent insists he get it removed. The mayor is not overly worried. He does not feel weak or nauseous. Removing suspicious lesions is as commonplace as getting a haircut, clipping toenails. Everyone is dotted with moles. Everyone has growths lumping them. Their sunburned skin husks away like the peelings of an onion. The UV exposure with no ozone layer to filter cooks them, mutates their cells. His doctor, a man with an eggishly bald head and a nest of black hair rimming it, seats him in a chair and gives him an opiate that a few minutes later makes everything fuzzy around the edges.
"It feels like nothing could ever possibly hurt," Thomas says.
And the doctor says, "I'm sorry to contradict you," and slices off the top of his ear with a pair of clippers. He hears the snip. Blood runs into his ear. The doctor smashes a towel against it and tells Thomas to hold it. The pain takes a moment to arrive, a rising heat. Thomas begins to say,
ah,
and the doctor says, "You'll be all right." Then he smears glue over the wound and bandages it and tells Thomas to follow up with him if he has any questions. Thomas is late because of the procedure, but then again, he is always late. People wait for him, and they will continue to wait for him, whether for 5 or 50 minutes, as long as it takes. When he walks into a room, any room, people feel both relief and exasperation. For so many decisions he makes, this is his intention, to make clear his power. Slade meets him in the hallway.
"How are they?"
Thomas asks, and Slade says, "They're impatient. Pimpton threatened to leave."
"Perfect."
He opens the tall oak door, and together they walk into the high-ceilinged chamber. Slade stands in the corner. A chandelier fitted with candles hangs over a long wooden table around which 6 councilmen are seated. They stand when he enters, though none of them greet him. Only a few even look at him. Some are men, some are women, some are young, and some have been serving longer than Thomas has been alive. And they look at gray beards with hunchbacks, taking too long to wobble upright at his entrance. Thomas takes his seat in a tall leather-backed chair at the head of the table.
"I call this meeting to order. The minutes, please."
Councilman Pimpton falls back into his chair and sighs theatrically. He walks with a cane made from a crooked length of wood. His eyebrows are combed up his forehead like white feathers.
"I've lost too many minutes already. Waiting."
He says this at a mutter just loud enough for everyone to hear. Last week's minutes about the creation of a water committee and the proposed construction of a new well are read and approved. Not that Thomas believes there is more water to be found, but they need to look like they are trying. Rain is the real answer, but they can't make a motion to sequester clouds. The blinds are closed, the room dark except for the candles sparking above them. Water glasses are staggered around the table, along with 2 sweating pitchers. Thomas fills his glass to the very top and takes a small sip and pops his lips.
"New business for today's agenda?"
Pimpton raises a hand. It wavers in the air a long moment before Thomas acknowledges him.
"What news is there of John Coulter?"
"What news?"
Thomas says.
What do you mean? What news could there possibly be?
I don't really know. That's why I'm inquiring.
I took him out of one cell and I put him in another. One much vaster. He's probably already dead, just like they're undoubtedly all already dead.
I'm sorry, Pimpton says and quivers his lips. Help an old man understand. Why did you send Coulter at all?
Because we needed to do something.
It was a symbolic act to make everyone
fearful. You run away from me and I'll send a monster after you. There's always the chance he might find them. Maybe. And do me the favor of killing them. Maybe. And bring back their bodies. Again, maybe. In which case, I'd have some lovely ornaments to decorate the city with.
You would think, Pimpton says, our mayor would be wise enough not to end a sentence with a preposition.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Let me try again. He clears his throat. In which case, I'd have some lovely ornaments to decorate the city with, you walking corpse. The old man pretends not to hear.
I propose we concentrate on actuals instead of hypotheticals. We need water. Let's figure out how to get our people some water. Let's be the leaders we promised to be.
I'm being the leader I promised to be. A realist, not a soothsayer.
I don't understand anything that comes out of your mouth.
Maybe that's because you're 1,000 years old and can't hear.
Pimpton scrunches up his face and waves a hand, dismissing him. The secretary, a shrew-faced man with an inkpot and a pile of paper, scratches down everything at the meeting so far. For a moment, his writing is the only sound.
Thomas says to him, "You don't need to record any of this. I'm just going to talk for a minute. I'm going to say a few things. Is that all right with everyone?"
Maybe it is the opiates, the bleary warmth, that makes him feel capable of anything, but he doesn't want to hold back today. He doesn't see the point of coddling this alliance of fools.
"I had a friend. He was a good friend, but an idiot father. Married to a woman who turned out to be an idiot mother. They ruined their children. They let them breastfeed until they were 9. They let them share their bed until they were 12. The children were never spanked or scolded. The parents talked things out. 'Why do you think you hit Sally? Why do you think you pissed on John?' Which only taught the children how to manipulate. And so the children grew up to be weak and precious, unable to function. Children are no different than puppies. They must be broken. They must be taught to heal and to roll over, or they'll spend the rest of their lives gnawing on the furniture and shitting on the rugs and waking you in the night for a treat. I am not a parent. I do not wish to be a parent. But if I was a parent, I know exactly how I would raise my children. Fear and love. Those are the fundamentals of leadership. You need people to fear you and love you."
Thomas takes another drink of water. One of the candles spits. A tongue of melted wax plops to the table and hardens into a white shell.
"Excuse me."
A voice. Pimpton's.
"Yes?"
"Who loves you? Who are these people who love you?"
His eyes flit to Slade, and then to Pimpton.
"You don't love me?"
"I most certainly do not."
"That hurts my feelings."
The old man lifts his beard and neatens it across his chest. Thomas says,
"I wonder."
"Do you?"
"I wonder if you would love me, if I tied you down. If I took a long needle heated by fire until it glowed orange and slid it into your urethra, would you love me then? If I held it there until you said so?"
The old man looks at him with his mouth agape.
"I bet you would." He gives a small smile. "Of course you would." "A question for the table," Pimpton says. "It has come to my attention you closed down a church."
"I did."
"Without consulting us?"
"I did. The minister was speaking out against me, calling for civil disobedience."
"To close down a church?"
His tongue moves audibly inside his mouth, clicking and popping.
"They're saying it's un-American."
"I don't believe in America. America is a myth."
There's a collective intake of air. Several lean forward and grip the arms of their chairs as if to stand, then reconsider. Thomas's ear feels so hot and his tongue feels so loose. The words tumble so easily off it.
People believe in America, but America is a myth. It has been since 1776. People believed in the country's greatness because it promised them greatness. Hold a gold coin just out of reach and say, this could be yours. 1% of the population controls everything. 1%! That's how it is here. That's how it was all over the world. That's how it has always been throughout human history. America's sponsored the appearance of freedom. I do not. They say I'm a liar? America was a liar. I'm a truth-teller.
But... This from a woman named Packer, dressed in purple with an acorn cap haircut. At his gaze, she pinches her mouth. Thomas fondles the damaged tip of his ear.
I'm making a motion.
Pimpton lays his hands flat on the table.
What now?
We're going to reduce the water rations again.
We can't.
We will. By a third.
The meeting goes on for another 30 minutes until they adjourn. Thomas was the last to arrive, but is the first to leave. On his way out the door, Packer puts a hand on his shoulder, and he flinches away from her.
Are you all right?
She says.
Of course I'm all right.
Your ear?
He touches it and examines his hand.
That's nothing.
The glue dirties his fingers.
Just a cancer I had cut away.
His eyes then follow Pimpton as the old man shuffles from the room and down a long hallway that will lead him to the entry that opens into the unforgiving, white light. Chapter 15. They don't want to waste their bullets, so they hunt with arrows. The quiver rattles at Clark's back when she sneaks along the game trail, a thin strip of dirt polished down by hooves. She pauses often to run her hand along the trunk of a birch tree and peel away a strip of its papery bark, to study the starburst of a white flower, to listen to the river bubbling, to watch a bird flit among the reeds crowding the banks. Everything is new. She feels as if she has stepped into one of those books read to her as a child, through the wardrobe, down the rabbit hole, up the twister, a portal that leads to the fantastic. It makes her feel giddy, girlish. Last night they stripped off their clothes and bathed in the river. Though it was only calf high, they laid down flat in the water and let it pour over their bodies. They spread their arms and legs and twirled like pale stars. They dunked their heads and spit bubbles. They splashed at each other and scrubbed their skin with sand and shot arcs of water from their mouths. When she sat up and looked downstream, she could see the water had grown cloudy with the sweat and grime washing off them. The water softened her, melted her, like hard-packed dirt exposed finally to rain. Her clothes are still damp. They stick to her when she moves. It is an unfamiliar feeling, like a tongue touching her all over. And she likes it. Her brother follows a few paces behind her. They come upon a clearing spotted with coneflowers and waist-high bunches of big bluestem, and in a crouch, they wait near the water's edge. At one point, she hears her brother's mouth open, forming a question, and she gives him a wilting stare. Shh, she says. After a time, her legs go numb, and her vision wavers. And then a deer untangles itself from the forest. A doe, maybe 20 yards from them. The big pouches of its ears twitch. Its damp black nose tests the air. Then it lowers its head to eat. This deer is nothing like the ones she occasionally kills near the sanctuary, their growth stunted and their bones showing sharply through their mangy hides. She can see its muscles jump with every small step it takes and imagines them peeled from the bone and spitted over the fire, dripping fat into the flames. She notches an arrow, but before she can rise from her crouch and take aim, she hears the snap of string, the shriek of a broadhead cutting the air. York. There is a sound like a fist smacking a palm. The deer jackknifes and falls and stumbles upright again. It starts toward them, then rears back and darts into the woods. Its back leg drags, an arrow spikes from its hip. They listen to it crashing off into the distance. Then she turns to York. His face is too long and too thin, and his chin juts at an angle as if someone stepped on his head when he was a soft-skulled baby. No one has shaved since they left the sanctuary, their water too precious, and his upper lip is wisped by a mustache, and his sideburns have extended into a failure of a beard. He is grinning. She is not.
I got him!
You got her.
Exactly!
Whether we'll ever find her is another story. He flinches when she starts toward him. She marks out an invisible square on his chest. Kill zone, she says, and then stabs a finger between his ribs.
But it was still a pretty good shot, right?
It wasn't terrible. They follow the blood trail for a half mile. A puddle among the pine needles, a smear along a tree trunk, what looks like a poisonous spattering of red berries on a bush. Occasionally, the grass crushes down where the deer rests. She tells her brother he must have hit something vital. Far enough from the river, the world dries up again. The grass yellows, the trees lose their leaves, dust rises with every step, and seems to give off its own light and heat when they breathe it into their lungs. They step out of the trees and onto what was once a driveway. Weeds have pushed their way through the fractured asphalt that runs up a hill to a three-story Victorian perched atop a rise. Its siding is gray, the paint long ago flaked away. A section of its peaked roof has collapsed. The wraparound porch is sunken and shot through with grass. The balusters, split or missing altogether, make the railing appear like a rotten mouth. They find the deer halfway up the porch, laid out like a sacrifice. The front door is missing altogether. The surrounding trim is splintered away as if clawed apart. Her eyes stay on the door, the black rectangle of it, a space that swallows all light, so she does not notice, not until York says, "What is that?" The white ball bulging from the deer's flank. At first, she believes it to be a swollen strip of intestine that has somehow escaped the gash, but it is not. It is moving, pulsing, tumorous. Tiny claws hold it in place near the arrow's shaft. There is the faint noise of sucking, lapping. Too late, she says, "Don't touch it." York has already reached out a boot and toes the thing softly. Its mouth peels away from the wound, and it raises its head to observe them. An albino bat with blind white eyes. It has the look of a shaved kitten. A beard of blood rims its mouth. She remembers what Lewis said about radiation, about mutational genesis. She remembers what Joea wrote about goblins. The bat lowers its head again, but before it can drink, York kicks it. It smacks the railing and issues a sharp cry. When it falls to the ground, they lose sight of it among the weeds, but hear it rustling and scrabbling beneath the porch. Normally, she would gut the deer where it lies, but not today. She heaves the deer onto York's back, and then, as he buckles beneath the weight of it, they escape to the woods. She might be imagining it, but she believes she hears something behind her, a shifting of air, as if the house were drawing in its breath. Chapter 16. Pimpton lives near the dome in a building called the Manor. He shares it with the other council members, along with the chair of the Farming Bureau, the chair of Waste Management, the chair of Finance, and all other elected or appointed officials. Like the dome, like the museum, their building stands apart from the rest of the sanctuary, with its marble floors and high, airy ceilings and dark wooded wainscoting. Paintings hang from the walls. A swing shift deputy remains stationed at the entrance. Pimpton's is a second-story apartment. One flight of stairs is enough to exhaust him. He leans hard on his cane and the handrail. He fumbles with his key, his fingernails long and his knuckles twisted with arthritis. Once he pushes inside, he calls for his wife, but she doesn't answer. Maybe out with a friend, shopping the bazaar. The room is dark except for a square of light. The window is open, allowing in the heat of the day. He mumbles a string of obscenities, caning his way across the room to pull it shut, draw the curtains, bringing a cool shadow to the sitting area. Then he collapses into his reading chair. Something bulges at his back, a decorative pillow that he spends a minute fussing with, renegotiating onto his lap. He folds his hands over it. His chair faces the window, and he stares at the line of sunlight burning between the curtains. it grows narrower as his eyelids sag. He can feel sleep pulling at him. Almost there. What never comes to him at night always finds him easily during the day. A sudden, pressing exhaustion. He will take a little nap. He always feels better after a little nap. An escape from the heat, an escape from the troubles the sanctuary faces, and the cruel idiocy of Thomas, who seems less a man and more a boy, clutching a wooden sword and pretending his power. He must be punished. He must be put in his place. And he will be, once the next election cycle's through, but that is a long ways off, longer than Pimpton may live. His eyes ache, his knees ache, his back aches. A nap will be good medicine for what ails him. Yes, a nap is just what he needs. The darkness takes him like a flung blanket. He can't be sure how long he sleeps, maybe an hour, maybe a minute, but he feels that disoriented dream tug when he wakes, the edges of the world slippery. He could so easily close his eyes again, but he knows something must have woken him. He calls out for his wife and receives no answer. She's hard of hearing, so he repeats himself, louder this time. With some difficulty, he rocks forward in his chair and twists around, looking behind him. The living room is shadowy enough that he at first does not recognize the darkness beside him as a man, as Rickett Slade, until the sheriff says, "This will only take a minute," lifting the decorative pillow from his lap and pressing it to his face. Chapter 17. Danger seems far away from this bend in the river. Lewis bathes until his toes and fingers wrinkle. He drinks until his stomach aches. The horses splash along the banks and feast on grass, and when Lewis walks past his own mount, she wickers and nuzzles his neck and stares at him with her soft black eyes, and he pets her and can't help but smile. The doctor takes a knife and hacks down some leafy willow branches and hands them out for everyone to swing over their shoulders to warn away the mosquitoes and deer flies. The earth has greened and blued. Water unspools beside them, the river ever widening. Flowers bloom in explosions of color that match the feeling inside them all. Joea helps them forage, showing them what to look for. Strawberries and raspberries and blueberries and gooseberries until their fingers and lips are stained. The flavor's impossibly good. They eat bird eggs, sorrel leaves, basswood leaves, oyster mushrooms, currants, clover, worms, grubs. If things are this good now, their mood seems to say, how much better might they be in Oregon? It is unimaginable. They dig a hole and surround it with stones and fill it with a pyramid of wood, and the fire snaps and pops and sends sparks swirling up to join the stars beginning to burn in the iron-colored sky. They eat the venison cut into chops and steaks. York takes a flask of tequila from his saddlebag and says he wasn't planning on sharing, but what the hell? It feels right. It feels like one of those nights. "You've been hiding that all this time?" Clark says. Her mouth quavers, as if eager to accept the flask. "There's water in the world after all," he says. "So let's drink." They pass around the flask and shudder and hoot at the taste. All except Clark. She takes it and stares at it a long time. Her mouth goes damp. Her teeth click together. Her throat feels as though it is widening to accommodate whatever she might pour down it. The coldness of its metal like a gun in her hand. Then she shakes her head, hard, and hands the flask to Joea. "Take a taste for me," she says. "A lot of tastes." The girl no longer wears bandages, her neck healed, scarred and angry red. Still, she doesn't talk. Clark bothers her as often as possible, no longer believing in the injury, believing instead that the girl is holding back, hiding something from them. It is more than her silence, it is her distance, the thin thread that binds her to them. She rarely engages, often staring off into the distance as if listening to instructions only she can hear. And her looks, eyes black, face dead, indicate her utter indifference, which seems at odds with her mission. Clark forces the flask on her now and hopes the liquor might loosen her, surprise a word out of her. But Joea only takes a nip and then cringes and trembles. She passes the flask to York, who throws back his head and guzzles.
York, York,
everyone keeps saying his name. York, they smack him on the side of his head and thank him for the booze and the meat, and he grins around a handful of flank steak. The flask circles the fire twice, and then twice again, and York's voice grows louder and louder, and soon he wobbles upright and tells them to make way, make room. He wants to show them something. This is his standard over the past few weeks. Teasing, joking, storytelling, always trying to distract or surprise them with a laugh. He is known for his mouth. He claims to have bedded more than 500 women, and every woman seems to have something strange or ridiculous about her. This one had nipples so long and rigid a bird might have roosted on them. Another used her teeth so generously when filleting him, he pronounced it felleting, that he rolled out of bed the next morning circumcised. He brings a hand to his stomach, feigning stomach cramps. His tongue peaks between his lips. He begins to dry heave. Out of his mouth, one, two, three, come yellow agates. He bulges his eyes in mock surprise. He tosses one of the stones up and catches it, then tosses another, and soon he is juggling them in wider and wider arcs. Two he lets fall into his pants pocket, but the third he launches at his sister. It whizzes through the air. If her reflexes were not as sharp as they are, the rock would strike her square in the forehead. But her hand rises up to snatch it. There is a smack. Everyone goes quiet for a moment. Everyone expects her to scold her brother, maybe hurl the rock back his way. But the river has mellowed her. She slowly brings the rock to her temple and makes a doink sound and crosses her eyes and slumps backward in a mock faint. Everyone applauds. The flask passes around the fire a few times more, and their words begin to tumble freely, their faces flushed, numbed. A pitch pocket pops, frogs chirp, the river hushes. A chittering comes from the sky, followed by the shaky nickering of a horse. Someone claps a hand and crushes a mosquito, then York clears his throat and announces that he has to take a leak so bad that the river will rise 5 feet in the next 5 minutes. They hear the chittering sound again, what could be mistaken for a high-pitched giggling. York is a few yards from the fire now, and he spins around to say he hopes nobody misses him when he's gone. It is then, with his smile a white crescent and his body ghosting into the dark, that a shadow comes alive behind him. And though everyone laughs at first, thinking that this is another trick of his, thinking that his screams might be an act, this is not the case. Something has him. Something is dragging him away. What it is, Lewis cannot see, his night vision blurred from all his time staring at the fire. Now the horses are screaming along with York. Lewis can hear their hooves kicking as they rear back against the harnesses that bind them to the trees. Lewis has had too much to drink. He cannot process what is happening. He studies Clark's face to see if he ought to be scared. She already has her revolver out. A muscle ripples along her cheek. She is standing, she is running, the gun's metal dancing with orange light thrown by the fire. Reed does the same, so does Joea. The doctor lifts a rifle to her shoulder and swings in an unsteady circle. No one shoots. They don't know what to shoot at. There is a piercing scream, inhuman, and York races out of the dark. Claw marks run across his face. In his hand, he carries a bloodied knife. He throws aside his packs until he finds his holster and belts it around his waist. Move, he tells Lewis. Move, 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 or you're dead. Lewis is unarmed. He never keeps a weapon ready, not like the others, but he manages to force his brain into action. There is no moon. They need light. They need to shove back the night. His eyes fall to the nearby pile of wood. He tries to run and trips. He scrambles on hands and knees. The first gunshot sounds. The horses keep screaming, a sound like metal dragged across metal. Though their screams seem fewer now. Lewis grabs what wood he can, feeding the fire 3 split logs, a branch full of dead pine needles. The flames rise with a crackling flash. The shadows retreat between the trees, and in the light cast by the fire, he sees the bats. Their skin is as white as moonlight. Some are the size of boys, some the size of men. One is splayed across the back of a rearing horse, its wings wrapped around its sides like some veined shell. It opens up the horse's neck and nuzzles into the arterial spray. Another horse beside it has fallen and gone still, though its neck remains raised, held in place by the reins knotted around a tree branch. Two bats feed on it. Reed fires his revolvers until they are empty. He continues to snap the triggers until a bat swoops down and he strikes it in the face and then commences tapping out the spent brass, thumbing fresh bullets into the cylinder. A sudden wind knocks Lewis sideways. He ducks down and cannot help but scream when he sees what displaces the air. The sky above is swirling with bats, too many to count, their winged shapes like pale mouths blotting out the stars. York takes a knee and fires a round into the sky. From the barrel comes a yellow shout of light. One of the bats screeches and wheels and drops heavily. He aims again, ready to fire, when a bat swoops down from behind, knocking away his gun and pressing him flat against the ground. Lewis starts toward him, ready to do what he doesn't know, but another bat drops from the sky, landing in a crouch before him. Slowly it rises into a standing position. Taller than he, its legs are stunted, and the steps it takes small. Its eyes are as large as a baby's skull, white and broken along the edges by bright red capillaries. Its mouth is open, and its teeth, sharply pointed, are the color of bone. White downy hair runs down its chest to its belly. It opens its wings like a cloak. He dodges right, and the bat follows him, stepping now in front of the fire, the red glow of it filtering through the skin of its wings and highlighting the thin bones and the filamented veins within. It starts toward him. Lewis makes his hands into fists, ready to fight, when the bat swings a wing. A wind comes rolling off it that scatters grit and momentarily blinds him. The horses have gone quiet, but gunshots continue to thunder all around him. He swings his hands blindly. Something hooks into his mouth, a claw that reaches down his throat. He gags, but the bile doesn't get a chance to rise before his head is yoked aside, the meat of his neck exposed. He can feel its breath as it draws closer, so hot his hair goes damp. A gun claps beside him. His right ear goes deaf except for a shrill ring. There comes a spray of blood. Not his own. He opens his eyes in time to see the bat slump to the ground. Joya does not give him the chance to say thank you. She shoves a shotgun into his arms, then she races off in the direction of the horses. Lewis remembers York and finds him gone, and he calls for Clark and gets no answer. There is nothing left to do but chamber around and empty it into the belly of the bat that spirals above him. They do not kill all the bats, though they try. The air shakes with gunfire. And then either enough of them die, or enough of them eat their fill, because their shapes become less frequent in the sky. When the red light of dawn comes, they clean the camp. They drag the bats onto the fire. There is nothing to be done for the horses. Lewis crouches over Donkey and runs a hand through her clotted mane and closes his eyes and apologizes for every time he cursed her obstinacy and slowness. Clark is gone. They have lost her. Truly lost her. Her body nowhere to be found. Whether alive or dead, they don't know for certain. But how can it be any other way than dead? Lewis does not sit so much as collapse onto the stump of a tree. Out of habit, he puts his hands to his sides as if to drag forward his chair to his desk. And for a moment, he imagines himself there, in his office, happily creaking open a book to study. But only for a moment. The image begins to dissolve even as it takes form. He is surrounded not by his library, but by death. He sits not in his chair, but on a stump. Beneath him are hundreds of rings, like the whorls of a thumb pad, some of them fat, some thin, the last of them barely traceable. If someone should happen upon his corpse later, like a dry, gray stick half buried in sand, he wonders if she might snap it over her knee and find inside a similar story. He has doomed himself, agreeing to this journey, and his last moments, these moments, would be his thinnest, his thirstiest. He takes a sniff from his silver tin, and then another. The fire is still burning. It crisps the carcasses stacked upon it. those of the bats, 20 of them killed altogether. Their hair smokes, their wings burn like paper. Everyone asks Lewis what they are. Bats. That's what they are. What else is he supposed to say? Ask her, he says. Joea says nothing. The fire dances in her eyes. Mutants, Lewis says. Goblins. Missiles detonate. Power plants melt down. Radiation spills from them. The rules change. In the previous world, the bats would be considered abnormal. But who in this world remains to designate what is normal or not? This band of humans might as well be considered the unfamiliar, their so far survival in this place unnatural. They are the mutants. His hands shake from exhaustion. The fingernails are rimed with ink or dirt or blood. It's difficult to tell in the half-light. He needs a bath in the river, but for the moment he cannot bring himself to do anything but sit in the shape of a ball and imagine himself away from here. He hears a voice beside him. York's.
Why didn't you do something?
He stands 10 yards away with a shotgun in his hands and tears in his eyes.
Both of you.
He gestures the gun at Lewis and Joea.
We did what we could.
Bullshit.
The tears track trails through the dirt and blood on his face.
I was there, in the basement, when you hurled my sister against that pillar. I was there in the stadium when she called down the vultures.
That's not how it works.
Oh, how does it work then? Tell me.
Lewis looks to Joea, and she gives him nothing back.
I wish I knew.
The horses lie in ruined mounds, with the flies already making a meal of them. Reed stands by the fire with the doctor, both of them slump-shouldered and staring at the flames that lick the spaces between the bats heaped there.
We're fucked. You realize that?
York says, his voice cracking, his tone that of a furious boy.
We are absolutely fucked. What are we going to do without our horses? We can't exactly turn around, go home, say we're sorry, can we? So what do we do? What the hell are we supposed to do?
Lewis licks his lips, as if they are too dry for words. It seems impossible that so many hours before, they all felt so hopeful. Just as it seems impossible that York, his face now tight with rage, is the same man who pranced and goofed around the fire last night.
I'll tell you what we're gonna do,
York says, and now his voice quiets.
We're gonna find my sister.
He tightens his grip on the shotgun.
That's what we're gonna do. She saved all of us, and now we're going to save her.
His voice breaks in the middle, but he keeps his eyes steady on all of them, until they nod.
Chapter 18. In the basement of the museum, when Simon slips from the ladder, when he holds out an arm to brace his fall and it snaps beneath him, she climbs down. He can hardly hear or see her. The pain so absorbs him, a hot sword that jags from his wrist to his chest. He can see his own bone, his inside brought outside, and he feels as amazed as he does disgusted, touching the sharp, slick point of it with a finger. Already he has lost so much blood. He does nothing to stop the flow of it, he just stares, and matches his heartbeat with its ebb and flow. Then the girl grabs him by the shirt, as if to throttle him, but she only means to rip it, a sharp blade of glass in one hand, the remains of his lantern. She slices away the fabric and tears it off him, and knots it around his arm to staunch the wound. She slides him out of his backpack, and he cries out with pain, and she tells him to quit whining. The worst is yet to come. Then she hoists him onto her shoulders. She grunts her way up the ladder, and in this way she escorts him outside, through the nighttime city, to the hospital, where a sleepy-eyed doctor sets the bone and sews the puncture and wraps him into a temporary cast and fits him with a sling. Simon faints more than once from the pain. During his moments of wakefulness, she berates him.
You are a world-class moron, she says. World-class.
Her name is Ella, she finally tells him. Her shoulders are squarer than his. She keeps her straw-colored hair cut in a pageboy. Her forehead is so often wrinkled with suspicion and consternation that even when it goes flat, it carries red creases. Her eyes rarely blink, steady in their focus, above a small nose freckled and rounded at the tip. It is still dark when they leave the hospital. He walks in a wobbling way, and she supports him with an arm as if he were drunk. He does not think to question where she is taking him. He is not capable of rational thought. He has lost too much blood, and the doctor has doped him with an opiate. His mind is a pleasant fog. At one point, a deputy steps from the shadows and orders them to stop. "They are out past curfew," he says. And that is all he says, because the girl lights into him, saying that there is nowhere else she would rather be right now than home, but Simon broke his arm badly, a compound fracture, and if not for her, he probably would have died, but she managed to drag him to the hospital, and now she has to drag him back home, and that's where they are headed if the deputy would only get out of their way, thank you very much. The man says nothing. He seems afraid that will only encourage her to keep talking, but steps aside. The streets are shadowed canyons Simon does not recognize in his delirium. They branch and branch again, and he wonders if they will ever find their way. "I could have turned you in, you know," she says. Not only was he trespassing in the museum, that was trouble enough, "but can you imagine what the deputies would do," she says, "if they knew he was roaming around beneath the city? They would make an example of him. That's what they would do. Whip him or hang him or worse. What was he thinking?" Simon shrugs and then flinches at the lightning strike of pain in his arm. He is not sure what to think of this girl, who never seems to stop talking. That's what she is, a girl, maybe a year older or younger than him, but she speaks with the domineering voice of an adult. She smells nice. He'll give her that. Grassy. The sky is beginning to lighten, and the first bell is ringing when they arrive at the museum. His backpack, he says, as she leads him inside. He needs his backpack. She asks what's in it, and he says a 50-pound load, some to sell, some to keep. A load of what? What could you have possibly taken from the sewer? Probably he shouldn't speak so loosely, but she has protected him so far, and right now, with drugs in his veins and a poisonous snake with big fangs seeming to twist through his arm, nothing seems to matter.
"I didn't find anything in the sewer.
The sewer is the way in and the way out."
"The way out?"
"The way out of the sanctuary." Chapter 19. The five of them stand before the house on the hill. A cloud hangs over it like a messy gray wig. The siding is pocked with holes from birds and bugs. The porch sags and blood stains it. They hope, from the deer the day before. Lewis stares at the black doorway, with the wood scarred and splintered all around it. There was a time, when they were children, when Clark bullied him, knocked a book from his hands, yanked down his pants and ran away, fired a pebble at his cheek with a slingshot, hog-tied him and hung him from a balcony. But there was a time, too, when they played kindly with each other. And on one occasion, during a game of hide-and-seek in the dome, he feared her gone forever. He searched for what felt like hours, peering under beds and in closets and behind doors, all the usual places where she couldn't be found. He began to cry out, "I give up! I said I give up!" And even then she did not appear. She had abandoned him, it turned out, grown bored, gone outside. He was reduced to tears and the terror that the building had somehow swallowed her up, until he heard laughter out a window and spied her playing in the streets with a gang of children. He had never felt so irrelevant, betrayed. He wishes for such a betrayal now. He would laugh with relief if she came wandering up, uninjured, whistling a song, asking what was the matter, clueless to their worry. But this time the game isn't a game. This time, a building really has swallowed her up. Reed grips two revolvers. He snaps off their safeties and starts up the first step. The wood cries out. A swirl of dust rises around his boot. Lewis tells him to stop. He reaches into his duster. From a pocket, he removes the owl, holding it out before him, cradling it in his long, thin hand. We need to know what we're walking into. He pets it, and its bronze feathers shimmer. The gears inside it whir and click. When he sends it off into the darkness, it flies noisily, its wings creaking. At first, they can hear it churning inside, moving up and down the stairs, looping through the rooms, occasionally thudding against a wall. There follows a long silence. They cock their heads to hear it better. Their eyes, trained on the black doorway, come unstuck, and they study each other with the questions no one need utter because no one can answer. Where is it? What should we do? They don't realize they're holding their breath. Not until they hear another thud followed by a ticking and grinding, and all their chests deflate at once. They can see the owl. Deep in the house, it is a glimmering hint, like a candle cupped in a hand, and then it grows brighter as it wings toward them and bursts into the sunlight. Lewis holds out an arm, and it comes to a creaking stop and roosts there. He walks to the shaded side of the house. The others follow. Daylight makes the projection difficult to see. So does the cracked and warped siding. They squint their eyes and edge closer to make out the wobbling blur of the house. The owl circles rooms and bobbles down halls and nearly knocks into a light fixture dangling from the ceiling by a cord. Pictures have fallen from the walls. A chair lies on its side. The springs have coiled through couch cushions. But there are no birds roosting in the closets. No raccoons beneath the beds. Anything with a pulse knows better. Then the owl bends around the corner and finds the basement, a dark door leading to a dark place. They can see only dimly. The stairs long ago collapsed like a rotten accordion. The plaster walls are crosshatched with claw marks. It is nearly impossible to see, given the speed and bob of the owl's flight. But the floor is a nest of bones, knobbed vertebrae, basketed ribs, skulls cavitied by black sockets. Among them, what appear to be fresher acquisitions, the empty sack of an opossum, two deer with bloodied necks, and Clark. At first, she is a mere flash in the darkness, but the owl circles back to focus on her, a curl of a body, her face half hidden by her hair. Yes, it is her. Reed says, "How do we know if she's even alive?" "We don't," Lewis says. But he feels it. A pull. It is then that the owl swoops upward, and they see the ceiling from which the bats dangle. Their eyes are closed, their bodies hanging tightly together, like a cluster of stalactites. How many of them it is impossible to tell, because the projection is already past them, heading out of the basement, toward the hallway, the light at the end of it, where Lewis waits with his arm extended. The air is dim and hot, the smell puffing from the basement, tangy and fertile, like marrow spooned from a split bone. A bare patch has spread across the floor here, where the hardwood drops off into the darkness, a rough circle a few feet across. He touches the splinters of it and imagines claws scraped across it night after night, a landing pad for them as they climb out and drop into their den. Lewis opens his silver tin and takes a dose of white powder up his nose and feels a little braver for it. The house creaks in the heat. Flies buzz in and out of the doorway, otherwise there is no sound. They do not speak, not even to whisper, when they tie one end of the rope to a heat register and the other to a lantern with a low wick. This they drop into the darkness. Joea and the doctor will remain above, their weapons ready, while the rest of them descend. Reed goes first. He tries to slide off the ledge as quietly as he can, but he carries two holstered revolvers and they clunk and scrape the wood. Then York bellies into the darkness. Lewis is last. The doctor gives him an encouraging squeeze on the shoulder, and he lays his hand over hers.
"You bring her back to us," she says.
And he says,
"I will."
Then he scoots to the edge and takes the rope and allows his weight to pull him down. He dangles there a moment, and when a fly lands on his face, he slaps himself in his hurry to brush it away and loses his grip. It is 15 feet to the floor, the surface of it strewn with the remains of the staircase, and guano, and bones. They lie scattered in piles still webbed together by ligature and papery skin. Lewis falls into the horrible mush. He is muddied with guano and cut along his hip, but somehow the bats remain unfazed by the noise of his descent. He stands and wipes himself off as best as he can. Reed told them beforehand not to look at the lantern.